from California to West Virginia, Louisiana to Illinois, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, a freedom movement is gaining steam in Cuba with street protests and a new generation hungering for economic opportunity. Dr. Lee Edwards from the Heritage Foundation is here to discuss. Efforts to craft a new infrastructure spending deal hit yet another roadblock in Congress this past week. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on what happened and why. Donald Trump made cutting federal regulations a priority. How successful was he? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine finds out from Wayne Cruz at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And states across the nation face nearly $1 trillion in unfunded post-employee benefits to their workers. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Cuba continues to suffer from poverty and a lack of economic opportunity. Now its socialist government has failed to adequately deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. All of this has led to a renewed freedom movement. Here to discuss the changing dynamics in that nation is Dr. Lee Edwards. He is a historian and a distinguished fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Lee, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Lee, let's talk a bit about what is currently happening in Cuba, what has been happening over the last couple of weeks. It would appear that finally the Cuban population is starting to rise up against the socialist communist oppression that they've suffered under for generations. Tell us a bit about what's been occurring.
Well, you know, a lot's going on, and I really do think that Cuba is at some kind of a turning point in its history. And a lot of things have come together, Loman. After it's been six decades since Fidel Castro came to power and when he promised free and open elections. And the Cuban people are still waiting for those free and open elections. Secondly, is a whole new generation or a couple of generations have come along, and they don't know who Fidel Castro is. He's dead. They know that his brother turned 90 and retired. And so they're looking around now for what's going on right now. The Cuban people are near poverty. There are no human rights to speak of. They couldn't even get adequate vaccine for the COVID-19, which is becoming a serious health threat down there in Cuba. And here is this vaunted health service system, which Cuba as a communist country was supposed to have. And now people are dying because they don't have vaccine. So I just think that the Cuban people have said, basta, you know, enough. And I just think these things are coming together. And I think we really could see maybe the beginning of the end of the dictatorship in Cuba.
In terms of the economic problems that Cuba is suffering from, Lee, not only do you have the fact that there have been some embargoes, but Cuba does have trade with nations other than the United States. So really, the economic problems, are they not really systemic to socialism rather than an American embargo, which is being used as sort of a whipping boy by the president of Cuba?
I couldn't put it any better myself. And let me give you an example. I was at a seminar today during Captive Nations Week and talking about Cuba. And I learned for the first time that Cubans, are you ready, cannot fish. There they are. They're in an island in the middle of the Caribbean, which, of course, is just teeming with all kinds of fish that you and I enjoy. But the Cubans cannot fish. Instead, they are prohibited. What happens is that the government buys frozen fish from 1,000 miles away, buys it at $1 a kilo, then sells it to the Cuban people for $5 a kilo. And that's how they get their fish in Cuba. So that's a sanction, not by the United States of America, but a sanction by the Cubist communist government and party.
There is a very large Cuban community in particularly Florida, but many parts of the United States, Lee, folks who have managed to escape from Cuba, and I do use the word escape rather than come in as immigrant, which we see happening from Latin American countries. Talk a little bit about the Biden administration's policies toward folks from Cuba who are wanting to come to the United States, but they're not getting quite the same treatment as others are they?
Well, I think there's a debate going on right now, frankly, in the White House. And actually, Mr. Biden, back in previous years when he was a senator, took a pretty firm line at times against Fidel Castro. So I think there's a debate going on right now about just how firm or flexible we should be towards Cuba. So I think it's up to those people who believe in freedom and democracy, which is most of America, to take a strong stand, to stand with, in solidarity, what's going on in Cuba these days.
You referenced a bit earlier in our discussion here, Lee, that some of the younger folks in Cuba, of course, they have no memory of Fidel Castro. Fidel Castro's brother retired at 90. The current president, President Díaz-Canel, is maybe not have quite the same grip on power. What impact is this younger generation having, and are they using some new techniques?
I just learned about this recently, the last couple of days, that there is a new movement down there, a cultural one. Now, these are artists. These are rap musicians. These are painters and playwrights and so forth, and they're all young men and women. They've come together, and they've formed what they call the San Isidro movement, and they produced a video, just a 4-minute video, in which they call openly for freedom, for democracy, for an end to Fidel Castro and communism. And this video, which is about 4 minutes long, I saw it for the first time this morning, has been seen 7 million times. That's an extraordinary number, and this had just happened in the last couple of weeks. So these are young men and women who don't know the first thing about, you know, the so-called revolucion, which is what Fidel talked about it for so many years. And what they're looking for is to share the freedom and democracy, which their Cuban counterparts are in places like Florida, as you mentioned a little bit earlier.
You, of course, have written extensively about socialism and about oppressive regimes. So as this younger generation in Cuba, and in fact all Cubans who are freedom-loving and wanting to improve their economic and social lot in that country, as they go about trying to throw off this yoke of socialism, what sort of significant challenges do they face? Because these regimes seem to be not at all hesitant to use whatever means necessary to subjugate their people.
Well, we know that's the case with these demonstrations, which were just a week ago down there in Havana and dozens of other Cuban cities, when thousands of Cubans turned out and said, basta, enough with communism, we want freedom and democracy. And so this Sunday, the Communist Party sent in all kinds of police and military to try to suppress the demonstrations. But you see, they cannot possibly, in my opinion at least, suppress the desire of these young people, and they all have iPhones. They have iPods. They have ways of communicating through the social media, which just cannot be controlled unless you have a far larger party and police force than the Communist Party does have down there in Cuba. So there are challenges for them, but these young men and women, and there was one of them at this meeting this morning, it just struck me with their courage, with their willingness to gamble and say, enough of this, we want a better life for ourselves and for our friends and for our families.
Hopefully this is a case where social media can play a very positive role. We have been talking with Dr. Lee Edwards. He is a historian and a distinguished fellow at the Heritage Foundation, of course, based in Washington, D.C. And Lee, tell us a little bit about Heritage. Also, where can folks go on the web? I know you've written extensively, not only about this, but many other topics. How can folks find your writings?
Well, particularly if they're interested in socialism, Marxism, communism, and so forth, lee.edwards@heritage.org. And so the Heritage Foundation, dedicated to limited government, to free enterprise, a strong national defense.
Dr. Lee Edwards. Lee, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much for inviting. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Scott Parkinson is at the offices of the Club for Growth. There has been a lot of activity on Capitol Hill this week. We're going to talk about it. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Loman. Thanks for having me.
As has been discussed now for many weeks, many months, there are efforts at coming up with an infrastructure bill. This past week, the effort at that tried to move forward, didn't quite get there. Tell us what happened.
Chuck Schumer is the Senate Majority Leader, and he put out a deadline of Wednesday last week where he asked all the Senate Republicans to vote to proceed to the legislative vehicle for this infrastructure package that they were doing through the bipartisan working group. And the bottom line is that the negotiations are still ongoing. A bill hasn't been written, and Republicans were very apprehensive about voting to move forward prior to actually knowing what those negotiations would look like. And so the Senate Republicans, even the ones involved in the negotiations, refused to go along with Schumer's heavy-handed approach on those negotiations, and they voted no on the motion to proceed. And so the bill stalls, and Schumer's really got to go back to the drawing board here to figure out if he's just going to plug in pieces of the legislation that he thinks have already been reported out of committee in a bipartisan, or if he's going to give more time to these Republican senators to negotiate. And the Club for Growth, we do issue advocacy surrounding economic freedom and opportunity and liberty. And we put out a statement this week really indicating that we think those Republican senators did the right thing by opposing cloture on the motion to proceed. But we think even if the bill was drafted, it's not worthy of support. And the Republican senators' support for a bipartisan infrastructure framework would actually be an explicit accommodation of $4.7 trillion in total spending. Let me say that again, $4.7 trillion. And the reason is the bipartisan bill is $1.2 trillion. And if that bill is agreed upon, Schumer and the Democrats are going to bring up the $3.5 trillion tax and spend bill on reconciliation. So what they're basically doing is they are accommodating a reconciliation bill that's done in a partisan fashion by jamming through a $1.2 trillion bill, the details of which, like I said, are still being negotiated upon.
We will, of course, continue to keep an eye on all this proposed massive spending that is working its way through Congress. On another topic here, Scott, there is a continued push by Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi to have a select committee to investigate the events of January 6th. And a reminder to our audience that January 6th was when the Capitol was overrun by protesters. Scott, it appears the Democrats are trying to drag out that issue as long as possible and even control what Republicans have input. So what has the Speaker done this past week?
Well, I think Democrats, first of all, understand that they can fundraise off of this to their radical base. And on July 1st, Nancy Pelosi named her appointment to the bipartisan select committee to examine and report on the facts of January 6th. And she included a bunch of senior Democrats like Benny Thompson and Zoe Lofgren, Adam Schiff, everybody remembers that guy from the impeachment proceedings. And they even included Liz Cheney as one of the Democrats' picks. And so she's got eight members of the House of Representatives that she was able to name to this select committee. And the minority leader, Kevin McCarthy, had the opportunity to recommend five members from the Republican side of the aisle. And then those would be apparently rubber stamped by Nancy Pelosi, and they would get on with this investigation through the select committee. However, Kevin McCarthy named five people, including the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan, out of Ohio, and a Republican out of Northeast Indiana named Jim Banks, who also is the chairman of the Republican Study Committee. And so what Pelosi did was she stepped in and she said, you know what, three of these recommendations are acceptable to us, but we completely object to the inclusion of Jim Jordan and Jim Banks, and we're not going to allow them to be named to the select committee through the minority. this is really an unprecedented action from the speaker in terms of blocking the minority's ability to name people to a select committee. It's actually never happened before, according to the House historian. And so Republicans are up in arms, and obviously this is indicative that the select committee is actually just a partisan witch hunt to continue to demagogue the so-called deplorables that supported Donald Trump, that apparently protested and like you said, overran the Capitol security.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, is with the Club for Growth in Washington. Scott, tell us just a little bit about the club today.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., and our organization is united in this idea of economic freedom and liberty. If anybody wants to check us out on our website, it's clubforgrowth.org. You can sign up and become a member of the Club for Growth for free, and we hope you will do that.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
For 4 years, former President Donald Trump worked hard to cut federal regulations. To find out how well he did, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine checks in with Wayne Cruz of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
The Trump administration spent 4 years fighting a battle against the federal regulatory state, and now the final verdict is in. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Wayne Cruz. He's the vice president for regulatory policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he is, I think, of all the people in Washington, D.C., he is the guy who spends the most time thinking about and tracking and writing about the federal regulatory state. It is all too often a thankless job, but we do thank him for doing it and for being here with us today. Wayne, thanks for taking some time with us.
You bet. It's my pleasure to be with you.
So you guys at CEI, every year you publish this this huge report, 10,000 commandments. It's a look at the just the sort of size and scope and growth of the federal regulatory state. The latest one, latest version of that report just came out. And the big number here is $1.9 trillion. That's the cost of federal regulations. Break that down just quickly for us. What does that mean for like businesses and consumers?
You bet. Well, this all came about by seeing the regulatory enterprise as kind of a hidden tax. We know what the federal government spends, and we know in the current year of COVID, the past year of COVID, federal government spent $6 trillion, which is a record. But you can't forget about regulation. I tend to think that if we're missing the regulatory state, we're really missing the biggest part of what the federal government does. I have a placeholder estimate that I describe in some great detail in the report of about $2 trillion for the cost of the regulatory state. Now, Eric, there are people who will tell you the figure's a lot more than that. Some will say it's double that. But given that the federal government refuses to measure itself, I like to take the statistics that the federal government does put out and what private sector estimates there are out there on the cost of economic, health and safety, environmental, paperwork, all that kind of stuff, and put it together in some kind of a placeholder that we can kind of gauge. $2 trillion, just to put it in perspective, that's more than the individual income tax and the corporate income tax combined. It's right at the equivalent amount. They're both right at around $2 trillion. In fact, the regulatory costs rival pre-tax corporate profits. So you're talking about a huge amount.
Obviously, some of these numbers, as you said, are a little bit fuzzy because the federal government doesn't really track them itself. One thing that is a bit more objective is that the Trump administration came into office more than 4 years ago with this promise to cut two regulations for every one new one. Now, this is the first version of this report that you guys have put out since the end of the Trump administration. So let's bookend that, I guess, by giving me what's the final assessment here on the 4 years that Trump and the Republicans in general sort of spent in charge of the regulatory state. Did they shrink it at all?
This is a big issue that I both love and that drives me crazy about what the Trump administration did. And I think the main thing to take away from it is what can be learned by a future potential president who might have deregulation in mind. The big thing, Eric, for the Trump administration, you mentioned the one in, two out approach to regulation. What that was getting at was a rudimentary regulatory budget, you might say. The real pedal tone of the one in, two out was to say, okay, if you're going to issue any new regulations, the net new cost of regulations have to be zero. In a technical sense, he met the one in, two out notion. He did other things too, like speeding up permitting. There were a number of Obama-era regulations in the pipeline that he stopped. There was use by the so-called Congressional Review Act to eliminate regulations that had already been passed in the Obama administration. There was a narrow window to do some of that. There were COVID-related deregulatory measures. I know you've talked about with a lot of groups, too, especially with what state governments did, but the federal government did, too. So those were some big, important things. The problem is, no president alone can roll back a legislatively enacted and then a bureaucratically enacted regulatory state. And worse than that, my problem with the Trump administration, and I hope that future deregulatory-minded Republicans or Democrats, if that were to occur, I mean, it did happen with Clinton and with Jimmy Carter, but Trump had a lot of regulatory impulses of his own. And if I were to just name a couple, you'd probably remember. I mean, he came in, even as a candidate, talking about going after the big media companies and escalating antitrust action. He talked about hospital and pharmaceutical price controls. He wanted social media content regulation, even issuing an executive order there. So those kinds of things, to me, that Trump did offset a lot of the good that he did on the regulatory state.
Yeah, so maybe a mixed bag for Trump ultimately at the end, some good regulatory stuff, and then lots of other things that also grew the size and cost of government. We're talking with Wayne Cruz from the Competitive Enterprise Institute about the regulatory state, and Wayne, just about a minute or so left here, so this is a big question, and I'm not giving you a lot of time to answer it, but I imagine next year's report, which will be the first one that looks at the Biden administration, it's going to look significantly different.
It's going to be a lot different, and let me, in answering this kind of query, I'll say that one of the good things Trump did, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it in this conversation, but one of the big things he did that was important was grappling with what we have come to call regulatory dark matter. You know, you've got a few dozen laws passed by Congress, but you've got 3,000 regulations that get issued by agencies. But there are thousands and thousands of documents, Eric, that come out from the agencies, guidance, notices, bulletins, circulars, administrative interpretations, all these things. Trump issued an executive order to require that all that stuff be put into a portal where everybody could find it. Guess what? Biden deleted that. So now I think we're in the era of a new Biden big bang of regulation, and I think he's much more radical and is going much further than even Obama did. So I think regulatory dark matter is going to be back on the rise. I'm convinced of it because of his elimination of the portals, which is horrible for disclosure.
Sure. I mean, why would you want more transparency on this stuff, right? I mean, why would we gotta sweep all that regulatory dark matter back under the rug where no one can see it, because then people like you, Wayne, will make a big deal out of it and they'll have to answer questions about it, I guess. We're unfortunately out of time for today. Wayne Cruz from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And again, that is Wayne Cruz. He is the Vice President for Policy and a Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Check out his work, including that latest 10,000 Commandments report at CEI.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Unfunded post-employment benefits represent a major financial liability for many states across the country. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Upon hearing the term OPEB, most people look bewildered, not knowing that OPEB, short for Other Post-Employment Benefits, is a trillion-dollar acronym and a massive financial liability for states and their hardworking taxpayers across the country. OPEB probably is the most underreported but financially troubling acronym you've never heard of. States owe just under $1 trillion in unfunded OPEB liabilities to retired public employees. OPEB can include items like health insurance, life insurance, Medicare supplemental insurance, and other types of benefits not classified as a traditional pension. Here at ALEC, we recently released Other Post-Employment Benefit Liabilities 2020, The Continuing Need for OPEB Reform. This new study is the latest publication in an annual series from the Alex Center for State Fiscal Reform, which highlights the dangers of unfunded liabilities for retired public employees, and it offers policy ideas for state policymakers to reduce these liabilities. Most states do not adequately fund their OPEB plans, and unlike pensions, many do not pre-fund OPEB plans at all. Currently, total state unfunded OPEB liabilities exceed $968 billion. Unless states enact policy reforms, unfunded OPEB liabilities could cause future tax increases or cuts to core public services in many states. Our new report is a guidebook for state policymakers as they consider how to address these massive unfunded liabilities while keeping the promise to retired public employees. The report found that following states have the highest total unfunded OPEB liabilities per capita in the nation. New Jersey at over $16,500 for every man, woman, and child. Hawaii, nearly $14,500. In Alaska, over $14,000 per person. In total, 46 of the 140 OPEB plans examined in our report are pay-as-you-go plans, plans that have less than 1% pre-funding ratio. Total OPEB funding ratios, which is the ratio of the plan assets to divided by the plan liabilities, is still dangerously low at less than 10% nationally. While the overall story of unfunded liabilities is troubling, there is some positive news in several states. Namely, Nebraska and South Dakota are two states across the country with no OPEB liabilities whatsoever. It's important to recognize Nebraska and South Dakota as models for potential OPEB reform. Plan structures in both states offer the ability for current employees and retirees to purchase health savings accounts, whereby employees and retirees make pre-tax contributions and the state government employers match contributions up to allowable amounts. Our new report details the positive changes to OPEB liabilities also in places like Indiana, where they've substantially reduced their unfunded OPEB liabilities. We discuss Indiana's defined contribution OPEB option, where they've created a plan that reimburses retirees and their covered dependents for insurance and medical costs through an established OPEB trust. As an employee approaches retirement age, the annual contributions from the state, in Indiana's case, increase, providing the highest payments to those closest to retirement. These reforms have helped Indiana keep their unfunded OPEB liabilities low. Since last year's report, Indiana has reduced their total unfunded liabilities by roughly 11%, from $620 million to $552 million. While the option to enter the defined contribution OPEB plan is available, defined benefit OPEB plans are still available to new hires after they've been vested. By enrolling all new state employees in a defined contribution plan and pre-funding their defined benefit plans that are still in place, Indiana could even be better prepared for unexpected economic downturns. Unfunded OPEB liabilities can grow rapidly and strain state budgets and state taxpayers, especially when coupled with unfunded pension liabilities, which total in the trillions of dollars as well. With improvements to government financial transparency, thankfully states can no longer ignore or hide the nearly $1 trillion in total unfunded OPEB liabilities across America. Policymakers should be looking for solutions that reduce the fiscal stress of unfunded liabilities. States that introduced defined contribution OPEB plans, such as Indiana, Nebraska, and South Dakota, proved that this policy challenge is not insurmountable. Their reforms have reduced costs to taxpayers and improved long-run OPEB solvency for public employees. Once again, our 50 states, the 50 laboratories of democracy, provide us with smart policy reforms that can help lawmakers solve these massive challenges of OPEB liabilities. For American Radio Journal, this is Jonathan Williams. For more information, go to alec.org.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WZFCAM in Winchester, Virginia. Welcome to our new listeners in the Old Dominion. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.